Do you enjoy this podcast? Have you listened to the archives from the last 7 years? With over 500 episodes? Would you like another 500 over the next 7 years? Then make a donation to this listener-supported show. You can do so online at paypal.me/permaculturepodcast or by dropping something in the post. The Permaculture Podcast, P.O. Box 16, Dauphin, Pennsylvania, 17018. This is the Permaculture Podcast. I'm Scott Mann. My guests today are five members of the Mud Girls Natural Building Collective, a Canadian, women-owned and operated group of builders who focus on materials and techniques like cob, earthen plaster, earthen floors, and living roofs. They are also the authors of the recently released Mud Girls Manifesto from New Society Publishers. In this episode, we take our time to focus on the role of supporting one another in our lives and business, the importance of friends and family, ways we can make classes more accessible, and the importance of low-tech building for global sustainability and personal stability. Enjoy this conversation with the Mud Girls, who joined me from a build site in British Columbia, Canada, via Skype huddled around a laptop, and I'll join you again afterward. And so today, the Mud Girls, Claire, Rosie, Yolanda, Amanda Ray, and Rose, what would you like to share with us about how you came to natural building and creating the Mud Girls Natural Building Collective?
I think what brought us all to natural building, and it's a question we can kind of answer for each other to a certain extent, although we all have our own, you know, specific needs and interests that brought us to it. But as a group, I think we had a lot of things in common going into it. We were pretty much urban people with not a lot of, you know, survival skills and with immediate needs. And this is, you know, like 2007 when it was all about peak oil and we thought the oil was going to run out. And so we had a real sense of hardcore urgency. Like, we don't have any money. We don't have any skills. The oil's about to run out. We have families. How do we provide housing for ourselves in a way that doesn't contribute to the huge mess we've made in the world? We're feeling a sense of responsibility and a sense of urgency to provide ourselves with our very basic needs. And we all came together at a workshop initially, not the people who are necessarily sitting here now, because the collective has changed membership over the years, although there's a few core members. But there was a workshop offered that some of us saw. It was women only, which felt very accessible to us. And we knew a little bit about the concept of cob in particular, which also seemed very accessible. This seemed like a way in to satisfy basic needs with basic materials and, you know, your own hands and feet. So it seemed very primal and a direct way of addressing urgent needs.
That's how I think of it.
And so was it then in 2007, around that time that you took that workshop, that you began the collective? Or did that come later?
The idea for the collective came about a year later, after our founder, Jen Gobby, had this series of workshops that I was just talking about that some of us attended. She also, I guess, just had such a great time and found it to be such a powerful experience, as it was for most of us, that she extended an invitation for whoever wanted to come back and try and start a collective, which was kind of a mind-boggling feat, because over 20 women ended up showing up with just a few basic ideas of like how to even go about starting a collective. So yeah, that was pretty wild. But yeah, it was about like from those initial series of workshops, it was about a year later that the idea for starting a collective came about.
And why that choice for a collective?
So this is Amanda Ray. It was a way for us to all build something of our own with the help of other people. So it started as a barter collective where we would all spend time working on each other's projects to build skills together, but also to have a group of people to help provide yourself with basic shelter. So it was a really attainable way to have your friends come over and help you build something, and then you go to someone else's place and help them build something.
Yeah, so things had started as a barter collective, and I think Jen saw a market also for work, and had this is Rose speaking, had an interest in alternative ways of running things and kind of a, like, what are alternatives to the capitalist model? That was also part of it, I think. So she was brainstorming different ways to make the collective work. And some of the ideas she had at the very beginning that we discussed, some models for how that would work, didn't really, like, it has evolved a lot since then. We share the same core principles, but, like, you know, there was, like, the concentric circles model, you know what I mean? Like, we sort of...
Models of decision-making.
Yeah, discussed different ones, and then what was natural sort of evolved based out of that.
Yeah, because one of the, you know, basic urgent needs that that I was talking about before was, you know, how do we employ ourselves as some of us being single mothers, and the reality of our, where we lived, our geographical location in the Gulf Islands and the coast of BC, where when you live more rurally, dog fight, when you live more rurally, the reality is there's a real gender divide sometimes, you know, where the women end up doing gardening and childcare and the men get the paid work, which is usually involves like digging things and building things. So how do you address that gender divide in work and provide sustainable paid work for women in our geographic area? You know, when couples broke up, sometimes the women would have to leave and move back to the city because they couldn't support themselves.
What you speak to is something that I've encountered in other conversations with people in rural communities. But there's a women's focused homestead group that came together for similar reasons here in the United States, because it's when you're in a rural location, if with farming in particular, you know, if your husband is working off the farm, if you're part of that kind of a traditional family, very often it's the women who are taking on not only the like social and emotional work, but they're also taking on a lot of the physical labor around the farm, as if their husband goes out and perhaps feeds and milks the animals in the morning, he goes off to a day job. They're then responsible for the farm for the next 8, 10, or 12 hours. While that family member is away, they're still taking care of all these emergencies, calling the vet and taking care of things without their own direct income. And then as things change, unless they have access to resources or their own extended family who's in that kind of situation, that if something happens to the family or happens to the farm, that they're kind of left out of a continuing economic structure, because of many of those positions or jobs aren't available in those rural settings that might be seen culturally as traditional roles for women. And so, you know, many of those jobs aren't open. And I feel weird speaking about this from like my place as a man, yet looking at my own situation because of having been, I was the one who came and became a stay-at-home father. And the experiences that I had of not having some of the social structures that exist then within like traditional gender roles. And then the way that that extends these other things that we're doing, that if someone wants to focus on a homestead or on building, the kinds of things that we encounter then by pushing against some of these stereotypical roles. And I'm wondering how, as you've developed the collective, the ways that that has provided support for you in order to continue your work in something that might be seen as non-traditional for you.
First of all, I just want to say, Scott, speak it. Like, don't worry about your gender when you talk about those kind of things. It is true. There's a gender divide all over the world. We know it now. It's very publicized. And it is a thing, and it was a thing that we recognized from the beginning. And so one of our main aspects of what we do is that we provide childcare within our collective. So when we host workshops or get hired as a crew job, if one of our members has children that need to be with them, we hire a mud girl to actively take on what we call our youth facilitator role. And so all of our workshops have built-in childcare, and our crew jobs that need them have built-in childcare as well, making it really accessible for mothers to be part of the collective and participate in what we do.
For all parents that whose children are dependent on them.
Yeah. Because we do have, you know, single dads come to the workshop. And we work with men. And yeah, it's like, it was such a huge step, and it kind of blew our own minds when we decided, like, let's have childcare at our jobs, and we will have the client pay for the childcare. It will be another job that is just as important as building what we're there to build or teaching what we're there to teach.
Yeah, the idea that parents would have I mean, in our case, mothers, because we are a women's collective, equal access to labor at equal pay. And so the mother doesn't have to then give all her money towards childcare, you know, half her wage or whatever, like, or more than half, that we would share that expense by making it just part of the job. As you know, the job would have childcare if it was needed. It would just be included. And ultimately, like for me, that is what got me involved in natural building, which was your first question. And also what has made this work possible for me. My kids are older now. It's not an issue. But at the time, like when I saw that first workshop that I took, I had been interested in building and not even really thinking about natural building. I mean, I was an environmentalist and so it all fit together. But I saw a workshop there was a building workshop that had childcare included. And that's why I took it. Uh-huh. And then I was able to keep work with that collective because childcare was included. And so it just, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm here.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge part of what we do. There aren't, like, we don't happen to have our kids with us here now, but it just changed everything for us to welcome in that thought, to welcome the reality that people have children and to...
Children, part of permaculture.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's part of the world. How are you going to work with that instead of against it, or put that off in a little box somewhere? You're going to miss out on working with a lot of amazing people if you don't figure out how to welcome in the reality that people have children.
It's such a revolutionary concept, but when I think about it now, it seems like, of course, that is the way it is. And when I talk to potential clients and I tell them about this childcare, I try not to stress it so that they think too much about it because it's so different, but I definitely mention it. And when people are like, oh, that's so different, I forget that that's actually not the way of the normal way of business, especially for building.
Yeah, really.
Because it's just how we've done it for so long. And it just makes sense.
Not to say it's not without its challenges, big time. Like, yeah, it's not always easy to include, have kids around, for start, all of them when you're doing, trying to get work done.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I would rather them not be around, for sure.
Yeah. Especially and a lot own. Of times we're, like, camping on site for jobs and stuff like that. So just that, that's, like, presents its whole own challenges.
Yeah.
Including that.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, it just makes you, the more you think about it, the more you realize that compartmentalizing the fact that people have children in some other reality where they just don't exist. They're in daycare. We don't talk about them. It's just kind of a capitalist tactic to keep things in their boxes and people paying for all the specializations.
Yeah, and like to keep families separated and institutionalized even.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
When you really break it down.
Yeah, right. So it's a more holistic approach.
That because your situation required childcare, that you built that into what you're doing and make the labor involved an equal share for that pay, I think it's just a great thing to put out there and to make available to other people to hear, because it is something that is so, I think, unspoken of. From, like, my previous career in IT, being at the time the single person without a family, without kids, the push that was put on me to be there because, you know, you don't have these other responsibilities that your coworkers do. So why can't you be here at 1 o'clock in the morning taking care of this?
Mm-hmm.
But, and then though, the other side of that, you know, we have these other responsibilities beyond, you know, the 8 hours of labor, and that why are we continuing to put our lives into all of these other little boxes and not make them present? That one of the things that I pushed back against when I was in the regular working world, not doing this work, was that idea that, you know, my work life and my personal life were separate.
Mm-hmm.
I am a complete human being. And so I am going to step onto the job site with things that are going on in my personal life, just the same as I'm going to be taking my work with me when I leave, that there are going to be things that I'm going to be processing. Why divide these things? And now that I'm a parent, including my children in more and more of my work and making them a part of this. There's some things I was doing mushroom logs many years ago. And so my photographer was working with me and we have some time-lapse pictures that we took. And there's my son with his ear protection on while we're working with the drill and he's sweeping up around us, but we're teaching him about inoculating mushroom logs and the things that he takes away from that by not making it separate. And I'm sure that your children within the collective have a much better experience by being able to spend more time with their parents and to know what it is that they're doing, to get those hands-on experiences. And also, though, that you're normalizing childcare as part of the crew work, as part of the workshops, so that it isn't as rare or weird or strange. And the things that, like, I as a permaculture teacher can take from that to be able to include that in workshops and things moving forward, so that it's not a burden on parents to want to come to a class or workshop because they know that these kinds of things are built in. And then the way that we can structure all of this so that everybody gets paid, everybody gets taken care of, and is able to fully participate.
That's totally right, Scott. And it's been really exciting for us to have our kids around, and it's really good for them. Like you were saying, your son gets to learn these things about inoculating logs, but for us, it's our children aren't just learning about building. They're watching their mothers be strong. They're watching their community come together. They're meeting strangers and spending, you know, weeks at a time with people, and not just strangers, but because many of us in the collective have children and some of our kids are around the same age, you know, every spring and summer, they know that they're going to get back together with their buddy who's kind of like their cousin in a way. And we've been able to also raise each other's kids a little bit. When I started the collective, or in the collective, I had a 2-year-old and a brand new baby who was, you know, I did a lot of youth facilitating my first couple years because my kids were so little and I needed to be with them quite a bit. But I also got to have mud girls, you know, carry my babies around in backpacks for the day, or like help me out when I really needed it. Because when you're camping with two babies for weeks at a time and there's no availability for the regular things that your life has, the regular, yeah, comforts, it's nice to be able to have your friend, you know, take your screaming 2-year-old in the middle of the night because you just need to have a little bit more sleep, or all these things. So it really does. It just combines all your life. There's no separation, really. Like, I'm a mud girl when I'm at home cooking dinner, and I'm a mud girl when I'm plastering a straw bale house. Like, it's all across the board, which is pretty great.
It's such a great support network. And it's a real permaculture principle, too, where you're just working with things, working with the realities of things, instead of always pushing against them and trying to make them disappear for no reason.
I think another aspect that ties into the first question about the collective is it's really important that none of us feel isolated, because if you have a dream of being able to provide for yourself, you feel the weight of that on your own shoulders, and it's a lot to take on. It's a lot to get your head around. And so in the moments where you think, I can't do this, it's really nice to have a bunch of other people around you who tell you and remind you that yes, you can, and that they're to help you and teach you and support you. That's a huge part of it.
Yeah. And speaking of that, like, why the collective? Sometimes I end up doing this work on my own and it's not nearly as fun. In fact, it's kind of hard and sucks sometimes. But I often don't notice that aspect of it when I'm working with all.
Yeah. Like the
you
building,
guys are
the
like
actual
my
building.
Best friends, basically. So
mm-hmm.
it's like,
yeah.
The actual physical labor.
Yeah. Whatnot, it's not nearly as motivating as when there's like a gang of your comrades all going at it.
Yeah.
A little dance
we look
party
forward
breaks.
To it as yep. like our social. Like, it's not just our work, it's our social time. Uh-huh. You know, it's, I don't know. It just bridges the life factors even more.
Yeah, it's totally like you're saying, Scott, you know, like, why does it have to be work or life? Why can't your life be your work and your work be your life? Why can't it all be one thing?
And in doing so, the way that it does remove a burden of separation, you don't have to spend energy on those kinds of things, so you can focus more on your life and who you are and the work that matters to you and all these other things that are important, and strip away these veneers of things that don't matter. And what you say of isolation is something that I continually revisit here in the United States, and I don't know when it exactly happened, but I feel like there was some kind of a cultural change within the last, I'd say 40 years ago or so, where it's been more and more of this idea of the rugged individual and being off and doing these things on our own. And that, you know, if you have your farm or your homestead or, you know, some off-grid location, that you are going to be doing it by yourself. And all the skills and everything else that you need to build and grow in order to live and exist in that space. And that somehow or in some way, this story or myth has developed that points to like the farmer or someone who's living off the land as a homesteader, as someone who really is on their own, without really looking at or considering all of the other people who are involved to make that homestead or that farm work, And this comes from like my own personal story is my grandfather was a farmer and he had tons of people who he relied on in order to have his farm and be a farmer. But those kinds of things aren't often spoken about. You know, if the plow broke, having somebody come out who had the skills to weld it. If the tractor broke down, having somebody come out who knows about the engine to fix it, or the person providing seeds, or all of these other things that really were a community effort in order for that one person to farm. And that now, as we work on these things through permaculture, through homesteading, that we're kind of breaking that down again and getting to see all the people who are involved in one of us being successful at what it is that we do. And that in your case, as a collective, you're all working together directly and have these one-on-one and group relationships, as opposed to, say, someone who is using capital to purchase those skills or knowledge for a couple of hours to work on one particular piece. You can all come together and do it within your own particular interests and build up and support each other, not just on a project, but throughout your lives.
Yeah. The fact that we're a group means we're always bringing in influences and interests and skills from our individual lives and experiences. You know, for example, Amanda Ray is learning to do blacksmithing with somebody in her community. And maybe that's a skill she can bring into the collective one day. That's super exciting.
As the collective began around these workshops on natural building, and then as you came together and integrated these pieces about, you know, supporting one another and your families, making sure that you were able to make decisions together well, including childcare in the work that you're doing, and making sure that all of these values that mattered to you were integrated into like the mindset of the collective. How did you develop your skill set then when it came to natural building? Was it from like clay and cob? Did each of you have your own particular materials that you were interested in? How did that develop then so that you could do these crew jobs and working together professionally?
Cob was a natural place to start because it's such an abundant, readily available, accessible, safe, non-toxic material. You know, there's not a lot of technical knowledge or tools or anything you need to begin building with cob. You can use machines, but you can also just use your hands and feet. So yeah, we definitely started with cob.
And that was those first workshops were building a cob house in an off-grid location. So it was super low tech. And then, yeah, I mean, things have evolved over the years. Different materials have kind of come in and.
Yeah. Just to list, we've done light clay straw construction. We're getting more and more into that. It's such a great bridge between the off the grid, non-permitted type of building and moving more into making code connections.
Yeah. Yeah, it melds with conventional construction.
Yeah, we've also done straw bale.
And then lots of just plastering on, like...
Yeah, earthen plastering, clay plasters.
On any surfaces, like conventional
manure plasters, lime plasters.
Is a lot of your work the construction then with straw bale and light clay and cob, or do you find that you're doing a lot more work with plastering?
I think it depends on what type of season we're at. The last couple seasons we've done quite a bit of finishing, but the couple seasons before we did quite a bit of building. I think that the codes are getting a bit more rigid here, or more people are checking on them a little bit more. And
yeah,
so we're working a little bit more with just like eco renovations sometimes. I think we do kind of all of it across the board.
Yeah, it really varies from year to year.
Yeah.
And that's actually one of the things I enjoy about it is that it's not always the same thing. Like I do have some, I can't really say I have a favorite material because each one is good in its own way and has a different place.
Yeah. And it's all what we build with really depends on the client. Like people will hire us and we will consult with them. Like what do you want to use? What makes sense to use? What's meaningful to use? What are your options?
What does your land look like?
Yeah. Like what's the geography, the weather, you know, we wouldn't want to build a cob house in Winnipeg. It wouldn't make sense. So I don't know. It's different every time. It's a whole set of like questions and we don't want to, you know, just superimpose a certain kind of building in a place where it doesn't make any sense. So it's a real consult with the environment and with the client.
When we started as a collective, there was only a couple members who really had any sort of building knowledge, and we just sort of learned from each other in that sense, but we also tried to read as much as we could. And I think at the time I don't remember there being any like YouTube videos or anything.
No, it wasn't.
But I think we all owned a copy of Becky B's handbook. And for a couple years, I worked with a high-end earthen finishing company in my community, and took some workshops around the States just to sort of feel like I had
with
a...
who?
I took some workshops at...
Sorry.
I took some workshops at the Canelo Project and with Ryan from the Cadillac, that Cadillac company in the States. What are they called? Artisiano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, I was just excited about... Amanda Raid goes and takes these workshops and brings back so much like awesome skills to the collective. So
yeah, there was a couple years I was really lucky to be able to go and do a lot of outside learning. And now when you learn the basic materials, though, it's really easy just to sort of figure it out. I like to say that we just make shit up all the time.
Yeah, once you understand the principle, like how clay and sand are going to interact and what they can do, then you can experiment on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. They have so many different applications in so many different situations. So,
and then we tend to align ourselves with people who know things. So we all live in smallish communities. So you have the buddy who's really good at traditional wood framing. And so you go and get him or her to come over and help you figure that stuff out. And each one of us learns skills. And then twice a year we meet as a whole group and we do a big skill share.
And help each other build.
Mm-hmm. But like going back to your original question about like materials, favorite materials or choices of materials, you know, like we try to look around and see what's available first. You know, sometimes when you're on one of the Gulf Islands, like we often are, does it really make sense to build a straw bale house, which would be like beautiful and would be really warm, but you have to source those bales and have them shipped over sometimes on a barge. So does that make sense? Is that helping things? Or do we look around and see like you have abundant clay and sand on your property, or sand is readily available, or, you know, so those things dictate what kind of suggestions we would, or solutions we would come up with.
It's reminiscent of some of the other conversations I've had with people who are really doing on the ground natural building that don't necessarily come from a production construction background, is looking for those kinds of analogs for things that you can use to fill in for those materials that might not necessarily be available where you are. So, you know, if looking for water reed to thatch a roof, some friends of mine are part of a group known as The Push, which are currently located in Kentucky. And what they were doing in Spain was that they were thatching a yoga studio. And so they spent some time talking with other people who were familiar with traditional building skills to find a similar material in Spain that they could harvest that would take the place of water reed that they might get in the United States for that roof. And they did similar things when looking for other materials, is to look for what they had on the ground. I like to hear that because of what goes into transporting these kinds of things to where we are, and what does that mean for our on-the-ground situation, that some of what we were saying earlier about capital, that it's very easy if you want to, you can throw money at something and get everything that you need, but is it necessarily the best choice when we're trying to do these things regeneratively and with the world around us in mind?
Yeah. Does it make sense to, for example, build an earthship? Like our client of ours, Rick, he worked at the dump and he had access to thousands and thousands of tires.
Yeah. And newspapers and glass bottles at a time before they were so valuable. And yeah, exactly. So he built an earthship and papercrete structure, but then to ship tires.
Yeah.
I won't give the example, but there was another build where they had to barge tires over.
I know.
Quite a distance onto the island. And I was like, okay, that doesn't make sense.
That's ridiculous.
We had to get a client who bought all their clay, which I was just like, well, maybe Cobb's not your ticket if you have to buy all your clay. Maybe there's another, I mean, you live in the woods. Maybe we think about blobs.
Yeah, sometimes wood is the best.
We should call the Blob Girls Collective.
So it sounds then that part of your experience with your client is that if someone called you and said, I want a lime plaster exterior wall, that you'd want to go and see the site and look at their overhang and everything that they have on site and available, and then might turn that into a consultation to say, you have these pieces that are pros for wanting that kind of a plaster here, but these are the cons for doing so. So might we recommend this other choice, and then provide as much education as possible so that you can do the best job with the materials and the resources and the client's needs. So all those kinds of things get lined up.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's even within in the spectrum of green building, there are so many products you can buy that are kind of high end or like a little bit processed. You can have them shipped to you and they're technically environmentally friendly, but is it actually helping anything? And is it sensible to have it shipped from Calgary? You know, if that's where it's coming from, we don't think that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's not to say that every single thing we do is like always rigidly, like from the ground, as low tech as possible by any means. Yeah. But like we, you know, we still often will buy materials and from various sources, but we do tend, like on the spectrum of like eco building, we do definitely tend towards
beavers.
Yeah. Beavers, there's us. We've had this joke for a long time. Beavers, then the mud girls. And then there's, you know, all the way on the far other end might be like insulated cement, you know, or I don't know. But, you know, so so we can do all sorts of work and we're not always forcing everyone to do everything totally 100% local. But on the other side of things, that low tech, yeah, I don't know. We do sort of follow a low tech, non-capitalist, minimal consumerism model for sure.
I do like a good teaching moment, whether I get taught something or it's time, like clients get to be a little educated on what they do or what. A lot of people contact us because they are interested in some sort of natural building. And yeah, often everything kind of becomes Cobb. That's like everybody's, they know that word. And so they'll call us and be like, I'm really interested in a Cobb house, or I want a Cobb shed, or I want a something. And we'll go over and we'll check it out. And actually, they don't really want Cobb. They want light clay straw, or they actually want an existing building to be like eco renovated. So they actually just want us to put like a thick earthen plaster on something. So there's a lot of people knowing that they want an alternative, but not knowing exactly what that is. And so I think that it's really great that it's becoming more mainstream. People are getting more interested in the natural stuff. At least we're in our zone. And I love being able to talk about what options people have, because I'm not committed to anything. When I go in to visit someone, like as a collective, when we meet a client, I'm not committed to my way. I'm interested in what people want and how to help them get there.
Yeah, it's a problem that just like puzzling things out is so interesting. You know, what do you have here? What can we use? What's meaningful for you? You know,
what's your end vision?
One of the things that we often speak about in permaculture is that idea of meeting someone where they're at. And one of the things that I continually run up against is that a client will ask for something, but they don't have the knowledge or the language to ask for what it is that they really need. So it's based in a technique or something that they saw somewhere. And it's like, I like that. That's what I want. And then how do I meet that need as a designer or an educator to give them everything that they are looking for in a way that meets their needs? Something that I've often said is that I would rather do a design or work with a client so that they implement something that is 1% permaculture that actually gets done, than to try to do something that does not meet their needs in any way, but is 100% permaculture that is just going to languish somewhere. And blending those kinds of things together in order to create something that in the end, everyone's happy with and actually gets done, because it moves us closer to that ecological solution that we ultimately want. But we're still having to live in and respond to a world that is still structured within extractive capital-based models. So, you know, how do we move in the direction that we want to while still understanding we're transitioning from this place to something different? From what you've said, it sounds like many of the challenges that you encounter as natural builders are not necessarily the materials, that as you learn about the materials and develop your skill set over a couple of years of building, that the materials kind of answer those questions. You know, if you make a ball of a material and it falls apart, that you know that there's too much sand or it's not wet enough or something like that. Or if it isn't spreading properly, that, you know, maybe it's too wet or you need to adjust one of the materials in it. And that, like, as you develop those hands-on skills, that the difficulty then comes in more negotiating and working with your client to actually do the building and construction in a way that takes advantage of the resources that are available, the client's needs, and the skill set that you bring to the table when you start a job.
So our materials sort of become our problem-solving tools. Because, like, a lot of times we're also building on stuff that maybe already exists, and then we're trying to make what, you know, we're trying to, like, fill spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or make transitions, literally make transitions between conventional building and natural building.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how can we use our materials that we know and the materials that happen to coincidentally be on site or whatever to finish a structure and have it
work? Yeah, sometimes it's quite experimental, you know, like how does spray foam speak to speak to clay and sand and mud, you know?
Yeah, because the things are, they're always merging in a, well, not always in all our jobs, but well, we're working on one currently that's involving a lot of problem solving and just like what material is going to go best in this corner. And so there's lots of different materials end up getting used in combination.
But yeah, it's funny. It's almost like a metaphor for what you were just talking about, Scott, where meeting people where they are, we're actually meeting the house where it's at too.
Yeah, like what materials are laying around left over from what was previously done here, you know, like let's incorporate that. And
it's here. Let's use it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's help these things speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, you help to reduce the amount of waste that's occurring, that it's not just walking onto a site and seeing a bunch of drywall and going, oh, well, we don't need that. It's, you know, how can we use this and then apply the other skills and materials that we have?
Yeah, very much so.
So permaculture, let's reduce waste.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that I encounter is like the LEED system for deciding whether or not a building is green. And one of the people who I studied permaculture with was an architect. And he talked about how a lot of times that's just kind of a checklist. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you may have somebody come in and want to work on a certification or a particular work on some kind of a green certificate, whether it's LEED or something else, and then they're open to tearing out all of these other materials. Or, you know, their renovation is about kind of a tear down and build back up, which seems even so much more wasteful. It's you mentioned earlier, Claire, my interviews with Bob Tice, and it was one of the things that he and I spoke to was all of this embodied energy in something that's already there. And it's a part of the permaculture conversation often when we're talking about things that already exist, using those materials because of everything that's there and not having to tear everything out to meet perhaps like a certain psychological need, but making best use of these things, these little leverage points where we can make small adjustments for the best outcome. As you have worked with clients and materials, what have been some of the interesting challenges and outcomes for you?
Well, not that it was so difficult, because again, once you know how the materials behave, then they start talking to each other and they do some of that work for you. I think of Washington, where they had brought in a lot of bagged clay, but for some reason, what was it? Fire clay?
Yeah,
it wasn't like a robust clay, and we needed to amend it with something, but it was quite a remote location. And so we just kind of looked around and they had this like kind of road crushy stuff over there. We're like, well, what's that pile of unknown material over there that's just sitting around in your land? And we examined it, and it was like a little bit clay, a little bit sandy, but it was, you know, it was like wild materials that were just like added this element of robustness to a mix that really needed it.
Yeah. And the materials were just too refined. Like they had the clay and sand that were really separated and washed and processed sort of materials.
Yeah. They were so pure. They didn't have a lot of strength somehow.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, a strong, like, earthen structure is has a lot of variety of sizes and shapes of aggregate, ultimately. You know,
In theory, it should have been perfect, but
yeah. It's not just as simple as merging clay and sand. Like, there's all this.
It has to click together.
Spectrum of clay and sand.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the broader the spectrum of clay and sand, the stronger that structure is going to be. I've noticed that for sure. Wild clays are way stronger and less dusty than a store-bought bagged clay, even though that you're not going to have to sift it. It's a nice even texture and you're going to get the light color you're looking for.
And what an application. Oh,
so yeah. Nice. And it'll be nice, smooth and look really fine and perfect, but it's ultimately not as strong a material as if you can add.
Yeah. So knowing that, you know, we're just like, well, this stuff should work in theory, but yet it doesn't feel great. Knowing it's like, there's got to be around here something around here. Yeah. There is something around here we can stick in here that's going to make it work.
And the road crush, I think, was still a purchase material. Actually, it wasn't just dirt on their land, but it was one that balanced what the other materials were.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the most interesting, but it's an example of that phenomenon. Yeah.
Do you encounter similar kinds of issues in problem solving? Like if you're looking at doing an earthen plaster on a wall or an earthen floor, where you're looking for soil that falls within like a certain range, like if it has too much organic material, it's not going to work as well. So you may have to dig a little bit deeper to find something that isn't in that, you know, O layer, or going through and separating out some of those larger pieces in order to get to a material that you can use and is useful.
Oh yeah. We're often processing materials on the spot to get a certain effect or a certain feel or product that's going to work for its application, for its particular application, like what kind of wall it's going on, whether it be a straw bale wall, a cob wall, or a drywall. So we're always processing things on the spot, questioning, what does this need? Can we sift this a little more? Or does it need like a bigger aggregate, you know?
Does it need to be soaked or does it need to be used dry? Or
Yeah. Clay processing is a whole art. Mm-hmm. Processing wild clay is like, should we just soak this and turn it into a slip? Or should we grate this? Should we crush it?
Yeah, will like, the big rocks fall down?
Mm-hmm.
And you're answering those kinds of questions on site as you're working with the material, as you're making the decisions about what your next step might be. So each of those answers can vary, like depending on where you are in the process of applying a plaster, that you might have something that's more coarse when you start because you're mixing it with a straw or something to help act as a binder. But then as you get to your smoother finishing surface, that you're changing the way that you're processing to get to where you want. And it's this ongoing evolving process between the site conditions, your materials, and what you're looking to produce.
Right now we're working on a house that was light clay straw built, you know, not quite finished, built 5 years ago. And then also added on other walls that are plywood. So we're, you know, having to figure out how to finish some of the clay walls or the straw walls, put the aggregate on the plywood, and we're doing like 4 different batches of each coat.
Like slightly different versions of all the same material.
Yeah, as we go.
Yeah.
It's exciting because every wall is different in this house. So it's like, oh, we're done this wall. Now let's figure out the next. And you have to kind of look 3 steps ahead. What's the finish going to look like? How do I get this to be, you know, 1 step closer?
You don't always know. Like I went and looked at the job and I'm kind of brainstorming, okay, I think these are the supplies we're going to need to get the job done. But once you actually start doing something, you discover new things, mm-hmm. and you need to sort of amend some of those materials and supplies that you brought. And you might end up doing something totally different than you expected just because you encounter a problem you couldn't have anticipated or whatever. So that does happen. And I wouldn't say a lot, but
yeah, often. Every job.
You're right. Every job there is a problem solving and troubleshooting.
I think that's the main problems or challenges that you find in a job, is that it's actually impossible to plan it to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be something when you turn up that was unforeseen, or a material doesn't perform the way that you anticipated, or there's a small patch that needs to be filled, or
there's totally always different something.
There's always something.
So the flexibility is an asset in that way too, to be able to go with the flow and meet the needs that crop up and not be rigid ourselves, mm-hmm. with what we thought we were getting into or whatever.
Yeah. You can make this plywood talk to this spray foam, talk to this cob wall.
Yeah. They'll all get along.
We'll all love each other.
A consensus meeting with the, with the plastic and the burlap and the clay.
Yeah. Rigid foam insulation. I know you don't like clay plaster, but...
But when glue and sand mediate, then we can make it.
Yeah. I trust you guys can get along.
Yep.
That visioning that you mentioned is something that my father said to me once. He was a carpenter and built homes for many years from about the time he was 12 or 13 with my grandfather, and has helped me do renovations over the years because he taught me how not to use a hammer so that I would go off to college and do a white collar job and then have the income that if I ever needed anything done, I could hire somebody. And then reached a point in life where, you know, that didn't exactly line up the way that he had envisioned. And so now he's coming back and teaching me a lot of these skills as an adult. And when we were doing some reno, he was talking about how you have to start with what you have in front of you and look at it and then envision what the end will be like so that then you can step yourself through each of the things that has to happen in order to get you from what you have to where you want to go and develop a plan and knowing that if you've taken down the drywall and you've had to remove some of the joists or part of the floor or something, what is it going to take to put those back in so that then once that piece is done, you can relay the floor, put the drywall up. Once that's done, to put in a support rail, to put in your tub, and then all of these other pieces, so you go from bare studs to a finished bathroom, and so on. And I think that that's one of the things that, for me and many other people, when we first encounter this idea of building and construction, when we don't have the skill set or the background, is that not knowing a lot of those intermediate steps. And as we said early on about feeling comfortable to either be invited in to work with someone on a project, knowing what we don't know, or even feeling comfortable enough to pick up that hammer and say, I'm going to tear out this drywall and begin this project and be okay with the mistakes we're going to make along the way.
I think it's really exciting to not know some of the things still and to be able to ask questions whenever I can, even amongst other mud girls and then outside of the collective. And I think that we have a real advantage being women in a way, because I don't know if any of us were raised to be builders, like from, you know, a small age with our father or our grandfather. And so because we come at it with a willingness to really learn how to hold that hammer properly, I think it's the, your typical like male builder, we're not intimidating to them. So we can say, hey, can you show me how to use this thing? And it's not aggressive. It's not threatening at all. It's none of that, so that we can take this knowledge. I think that we have, it's almost an advantage in a way in our learning process. And so,
yeah. And it's part of our mandate really to always be learning. And in fact, you know, something we didn't even touch on, we won't be able to, we're going to run out of time, is all the workshop stuff we do, because we work as a crew, but we also, like, a huge part of what we do is run workshops where people come and camp and create this instant community. And you never know who's going to come and what skills they have and what ideas they have. And people bring so much, you know, somebody you've never met before that is coming because they consider themselves a builder still will have these amazing insights and problem solving abilities. And so, I mean, there's always just like new life being injected into our collective all the time through the people that we meet.
Sometimes those people who don't actually know anything about anything that we're doing have these problem solving ideas because they're not coming at it from the same place. They're coming at it from nothing. And so they have these really interesting ideas of how to get to wherever we're trying to go that maybe none of us would have thought of because we've been doing it one certain way, or, you know, coming at it from a whole different way, which is really an awesome thing too.
As so often happens with these conversations, I really only ever know where we're going to begin and where we're going to end because of the normal beginning and ending questions that always start and close a conversation. But in between, I really never know where it's going to wind up, just as has happened today, as we talk about the Mud Girl Collective and the way that we can come together to be supportive of the other people within our company, within our community, or within a workshop or class, so that everyone can participate and be supported and taken care of in the end, as well as this conversation then from there about natural building and what it's like to work as a group of natural builders on site using low-tech and on-the-ground solutions. And I really appreciate everything that you've shared with us today. But as always, before we do end our conversation, do you have any final thoughts for the listeners?
We hope that anybody out there who has a dream or a vision of living more sustainably, being able to do more things for themselves, or just being lighter on the earth, or and forging communities, forging resilience within communities, will seek out not just groups like ours, but, you know, all of the resources that you are providing on your podcast, for example, that they can give themselves the tools and not be afraid to just start, just begin from wherever they are and just start learning. That's what we did. We didn't know anything when we started building. We learned from each other, and we just committed to bringing in new skills, new knowledge, and forging alliances, allies, and forging
learning
communities.
Learning by doing.
Yeah, learning by doing.
And do it even if you're scared.
Yeah, don't be afraid to be a dummy and have fun. Make sure you have fun, because if it's not fun, it's not sustainable.
I really appreciate this first conversation with the Mud Girls. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Scott. It was great to meet you.
And that was Claire, Yolanda, Rosie, Rose, and Amanda Ray of the Mud Girls. Find out more about them at mudgirls.ca. There you'll find more information about their book and so much more. Often in permaculture, we talk about meeting someone where they're at, which is one of the things that stood out for me in this conversation with the Mud Girls. They're using the patterns they see in the world around them that make accessing meaningful work and ongoing education difficult. From that, they're creating the details to ensure that all members receive an equal wage, whether building or providing childcare for others. This extends to their classes and workshops that are low cost and also provide childcare so that families and single parents can attend and learn together. Claire and I talk about this in more depth in another conversation out in a few weeks, when we go into more detail about the history and experiences of the Mud Girls, their clients, and students. What patterns do you see hindering people from quality work or engaging workshops or classes? What details can we create from those? Let me know so that we can continue to make permaculture design and education more accessible and affordable for all. Leave a comment in the show notes, call 717-827-6266, email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or you can write me a letter. I always love to go to my mailbox and find something in there from a listener. I've got a box where I've been collecting them all over the years. And thank you to everyone who's ever sent one. The Permaculture Podcast, P.O. Box 16, Dauphin, Pennsylvania, 17018. From here, the next regular episode is an interview from David Bilbrey with Dr. Elaine Ingham to discuss the soil food web. Until then, grow your support structure and create the world you want to live in by taking care of Earth, yourself, and each other.